And welcome, everybody, to a special edition of Podcasting Them Softly. This is our second volume with cinematographer Ken Kelsch. Welcome back to the show, sir. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Likewise, gentlemen.
And, of course, Nick is here as well.
What's going on, Frank? And welcome back, Ken. This will be a lot of fun to dig into the stuff that we didn't get a chance to do on Volume 1.
Okay.
Yeah, last volume we talked about Bad Lieutenant, Dangerous Game, and 444, and then pretty much everything else that Ken went off on a tangent about that was awesome. So we're looking forward to very much of the same, excuse me, this episode. So I suppose we'll start with, and you referenced this earlier when we spoke, that The Addiction is your favorite film that you shot.
Yes, I mean, it was... For me, I think as a cinematographer, to shoot in black and white presents an enormous challenge. So, on one hand, it was my favorite, artistic journey. On the other hand, I had the money, so which allowed me that was a trade-off. Okay, you do it the way you want it, but of course, we're not going to pay you anything, and. It was one of those adventures that we tried to get something going so that Abel would be able to extend his reign over the gutter independent school of New York. And the script was kind of interesting. There was a lot of gender changing around. The Chris Walken part was originally a female. Annabella's was a male. And Lily Taylor, who, is just this side of awesome. And Edie is great in it, too, in a small role. But Walken, I think it was Walken was at his zenith at that time. He was just amazing. We shot in Julian Snobel's loft, which was great. But, Lily's a very gutsy actor, and... it's hard not to love her. She's just, amazing, whatever. But for me, on the technical side, first of all, I masked in 1/8:5. So I hard matted it. So you theoretically couldn't, I had been suffering from the horrible cheap-ass transfer of Bad Lieutenant. And, the thing is that at that time it was harder to just, to change 1/8:5 to pillar box. So, in my wisdom, I just put the mat right in the gate, and I thought it would be fine. But they figured ways around that too. Now they just did center extraction and made it into the 4x3 format, which was to my chagrin. I'm trying to remember if I did the transfer. I can't remember if I did the transfer or not, but I do know that I was very when I've seen it, I've been pretty pleased with it. The problem is that there was a Directors Guild fight with Abel, who was the producer, because he didn't get his residuals. So actually, the Directors Guild owns the masters. So that's why you can't. It used to play on IFC every 5 minutes. But now you can't see it anymore. I don't think I had to get DVD from Japan or something, and it's a shame because to shoot in 9 Shades of Grey with a small crew where you can't where you really can't have much artifice is a task because you're creating the three-dimensional fantasy in 2 dimensions. So separation is, of course, the director of photography's challenge. How do you separate the 9 Shades of Grey from each other without having, in the 40s, they just backlit everything. It was a little bit interesting. During my still days, I shot black and white. I love shooting black and white. The stuff that I had learned in the lab, the black and white lab, really panned out. And I was very flattered when Dom Donaghy over at Duart asked me how many black and white films I had shot before, and I said this was my first. It was really quite the compliment. But the idea of doing a black and white, Tucci wanted to do The Imposters in black and white, and I discouraged it because I came to the realization that people don't spend money to go see it. And as thrilling it is as an aesthetic vehicle, it just doesn't pay out in terms of people going to see it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, what's like the last big couple black and white movies? Obviously The Artist, and then maybe Good Night and Good Luck, Clooney's movie. But everybody went to go see that because Clooney did it and had a bunch of famous actors in it.
And Schindler's List.
And Schindler's List, yeah.
Well, you know, that's Spielberg making a ponderous choice. Like, hey, I need an Oscar. I haven't got one yet, so I'm making a purely, you know, artistic film about the Holocaust, which if you're making a German film, that's definitely you're winning the Academy, you know, the German Academy Award. If you make something in black and white, it's definitely a ringer. If you do it, you know, Holocaust film in black and white, you're a sure thing. So I don't know. I had some problems with Schindler's List. I hated the red raincoat thing, little girl. I just hated it. I said, why did he do that? The film itself, I thought it was pretty dramatic. And, you know, it is celebrating a guy who Schindler had quite the moral dilemma. You know, my particular, what I like about narrative films, you know, that whole, how do I do this? What do I do? Where am I giving my soul up here? Which was the sort of the story of the young philosophy student who then becomes a vampire. And again, it's the cast of characters in there. I think it was my third film with Walken, who just is phenomenal as Pena. His harangues about who do you think you are, and it just, oh God, Walken, you are the Christopher Walken, you are the absolute, just the best thing. And those two, you know, Lily and Walken riffing on each other, terrific. So, but again, we did that for next to nothing. I forget how little, you know, we had no Condors. Guys dragged my maxi boots up on rooftops. We shot in the streets. I'm sure we had no permits. You know, we did the normal shoot downtown A Street, borrow this, steal that, go there, shoot all night. It was pretty much our venue in those days. We were still running pretty wild in the street. And I turned down a great four-week film that they shot all around the world that would have been great. But, you know, I ended up doing my favorite film that I've shot. So there you go. When I say favorite film I shot, I mean it was the greatest, as a cinematographer, I liked it. I mean, I thematically think that Bad Lieutenant certainly carries a better narrative. I think that of all my favorite films photographically in non-black and white, The Funeral is great. You know, Desert Flower is great. For me, I don't know how the audience appreciated it. And then, of course, I think that as far as a message and a successful film, probably Big Night carries, which is 20th anniversary. You know,
it's funny that you brought up Big Night, and I know that most of our talk has been dominated around the amazing collaboration that you've had with Abel Ferrara, but if you don't mind, just because Big Night has been a favorite for me, a favorite in my family for 20 years now. Didn't it come out in 96, 95? So 20 years old?
It's the 20th anniversary.
Oh, wow. Oh, God. Okay. So what was it like working on that film with Stanley Tucci and that massive cast? And
oh, you know, it was, again, Lily actually pushed me to Stanley to get the job. So she said, oh, you got to use this Ken Kelch guy. You mean the guy who does those Abel Ferrara films? And And, you know, I went in there and I talked to him. And I actually had two other films that, and, you know, I was Ken Kelsch in those days instead of what's left of Ken Kelsch. And, you know, people were lining up to, you know, to have me do their stuff. And the trick was that Tucci couldn't make his mind up. And I was trying to not, and I was trying to delay the two other films so that I would have the choice of taking either something that was aesthetically pleasing. Again, you know, I read the script. I knew that that was the film I wanted to do. And, you know, the whole idea, the metaphor of artistic integrity, to, you know, obviously is a subject that I hold very near and dear to my heart. So, you know, I wanted to do it so bad. Plus, I wanted to work with Lily again. And, you know, I was a big fan of Tucci. And, you know, and Tony Sayoub, great guy. I was just a great guy. He's a great guy. And, you know, so I went in there and they offered me a third of the fee for what I would have gotten for the Jimmy Smith's film that they were sticking in front of my nose. And, you know, my agent was a little shocked at the time that I said no to the big money, which was a Hollywood thing. And I think it was just the DVD. And, you know, I have to say my idea of working with Tucci was not what was actualized. You know, I thought it was going to be, oh, wait a minute, here's an actor directing the film. This is going to be like HB Studio, you know, it's like this HB meets the Actors Studio, you know, it'll be Stanislavski, they'll be, you know, like really into the method, and au contraire, mon frère, not the way. You know, actually, Stanley is a very good director. The structure of the film that I think was provided a lot by his cousin, Joe Tropiano, was very well thought out. And, you know, we were very lucky to get just enough money to build that set down on the piers. And we got great locations. I think Sam Hutchison was the locations guy at that time. And, you know, Alan Lewis was casting. And, you know, Alan does everything. Every big budget film, Alan does. So, and, you know, Stanley pulled in a lot of favors. People were coming in and dropping out. The final cast was pretty much a surprise at the last minute. I think Ian Holm came in is there at the last minute. And of course, Ian's character is tremendous. The Pascal thing was it was a stroke of genius. Liev Schreiber's in it for 2 minutes. Unfortunately, the whole Mark Anthony. I had no idea who Mark Anthony was. You know, I'm some Anglo from New Jersey, so you know what do I know? Then I went to his concert on the 4th of July, and I didn't realize that he was married to Miss Universe, and you know, who's this thin, aesthetic, very aesthetic looking guy, and women are throwing their underwear up on stage for real, not like staged Tom Jones thing, and he was electric on stage. To me, it's just mind-boggling. And he took that small little role, and he did a great job. He never complained. That's the amazing thing on that set. There were, you know, A-list actors, great actors. There wasn't one bit of bitching about anything. And, you know, we made the film for next to nothing. And the money went on into the film. Plus, you know, the food stylist, she did a great job. DePano was from Stanley's family recipe. He went to cooking school. Tony went to cooking school for actually quite a while. And the food was great. I took a DePano home with me. Even the catering for a $3.5 million film was pretty pretty great. Also, the fact is that there was no actor studio shenanigans. Stanley had an idea. He co-directed it with Campbell. Campbell is another, she's like me, another hard-headed Celt. And when my mom came to visit, actually, it was my mother's 70th birthday. And my mom's MacArthur. The Campbells are sort of the traditional enemies of a lot of the clans of Scotland. In actuality, historically, the Campbell clan beheaded the two titular heads of the MacArthurs, so there could never be a blood, another blood, basically clan chief. So the MacArthurs still, they have a hard on against the Campbells ever since. So Campbell said, when he introduced himself to my mom, he said, it's a family name. We're not really Campbells. So my mother appreciated that. And I got it, but nobody else did at all. And the MacArthurs have been trying to get the Campbell, money for, 1,000 years, whatever. But that was how gracious Campbell was. Great guy. He's pretty funny as the bisexual, used car salesman. I had the best time in that set. I really did. I knew from the get-go that it was going to be a really good film.
Yeah, it's long been a favorite, and I'm glad that the experience was as pleasurable as it is watching it.
Well, I wish I had the concession stand for the popcorn. Because I'm sure there's a lot of food going down there, the thing is that I worked on as a gaffer on a film with Cartel, in the early '80s, and it was an Italian crew with Pietro Panori was the DP who did Arabian Nights for Pasolini, I love the Italians, and maybe it's because I it's funny because I'm Celtic and German, so I come from a cold water environment, but my personality is very Italian or very Mediterranean. I'm very my emotions are usually very grandiose, and I appreciate that whole. I appreciate the Italians' passion. For as the grip one day said to me, Ken, in Italy, we have three things we care about. What's that? That would be food, wine, and women, and not that order. I said, hey, man, this is like it, man. This is, you guys have hit the nail right in the head. That's what life is about. Throw in a cinema, I'm a happy guy.
That's awesome. I wanted to ask you real quick before we move on to the funeral is, what can you tell us about Nicholas St. John? Because I can't find anything really about him other than he was the screenwriting partner of Abel's.
Nicky chooses to live his life, his reclusive life. Nicky's a great guy. I love Nicky. And, his choice is to walk away from the business. He's a very religious guy. He goes to church every day. He's married to an old country Italian woman, and I love Nicky. Nicky's really great. He has a real dilemma because he wrote movies early on that everyone was condemned by the Catholic Church.
Right.
I think that one day Nicky just sort of said, I had it. I'm not going to do it anymore. And, I know where he lives. I've talked to him. He's very private. I wouldn't want to share anything more than that. I think he has achieved what he wanted to achieve. I'm sure he would like to do a little bit more. I admire somebody that can walk away from the trappings of and the ego of this business and find, you know, his joy in being in a married relationship with a person and raise a family and just, you know, walk that path. To me, it makes no difference. You know, it makes so little difference in the long run. You know, I don't want to be, I'm not the Buddha here. I'm not Pope Francis, but, you know, sometimes I spent 2 years in a seminary when I was a kid. So, you know, I was a very religious kid, and I sort of, which is probably, you know, for me, the whole path of going from, you know, a Franciscan seminarian to a Green Beret, in Max Sog, you know, the original door kickers of the most secret organization in the Vietnam War, and then going to film school, going to undergraduate and putting up with the bullshit of sniveling college students, and then going to graduate school and putting up with the bullshit of sniveling grad students, and then the thing that helped me was that I had always been working, and I would say 90% of my graduate school class was out of the business the first year. Now, you know, we had some, you know, Bill Pope just finished Jungle Boy, and I want to see that because, it was one of my favorite movies as a kid. So I watched that maybe 300 times. So I'll be really curious to see what job he did on that. But it looks great, Sonnenfeld, they were best buddies in grad school, Barry and Bill Pope, and who else? Well, I guess Spike was undergraduate, so I really didn't know him. Seidelman, I worked on her film, and I worked with her in TV too. She did one record, one show in Now and Again. But, by and large, what drove me through the business was the same determination I had when I was going through the hard-ass schools that I went through in the Army. I'm never quitting. You can make me hate you. You can cut my hamstrings. I'm going to crawl towards the finish line. It ain't going to happen. And I think that was what got, and also the fact that I had, a real work ethic. If you don't have a work ethic and you can't work 16 hours a day, and also I was prepared early on in my career to do anything. I mean, the first film I worked on, I was helping the electrics and I was booming at the same time for the sound guy. So I would do anything for me to get on a film crew set. And, that's the name of the game. You know, it must be worse now because they're puking out, regurgitating, you know, 50 million kids every year when you have 400 picture starts in the United States. Or you can go to TV, which is where you're even more disposable than you were in the film world.
So The Funeral, you were nominated for Best Cinematographer for the Independent Spirit Awards.
Yeah. It was me. Pope was on for Bound. And Roger Deakins won for Fargo. Funny, because I didn't really think that was his best film. I mean, I think he's a great DP. Probably one of the, you know, top five. But, you know, for me, that did nothing. And I thought that Pope did a phenomenal job on Bound.
Yeah, Bound is awesome.
I remember seeing Bound in the theater and just being completely blown away.
Yes. Bill's a talented guy. There's no doubt about it. I don't think he returns my phone calls anymore that he's, I sponsored him ASC, but, he's a big shot now. So, Spider-Man, blah, blah, blah. What am I doing? I'm doing independent films still at, 107. So there you go.
Yeah, but you shot Welcome to New York, which we'll get to shortly.
I am entirely happy with the direction of where my career has gone. You know, for me, if I was going to do, I just saw Deadpool, which I liked a lot, but
yeah, I did too.
By and large, I'm not really interested in Marvel Comics. For me, I like the genre that I work in. I don't have, first of all, I'm not the Teflon kind of finger pointing, oh, it wasn't me, DP that is an A-list guy. I don't know if that's because I don't have the talent. I think that in many cases, I think I do. But the problem is that I don't have the makeup. You know, if you're an asshole, chances are I'm telling you you're an asshole. Or if I'm not telling you, which is probably what's going to happen, you know, it's all over my face. And, you know, I work for a lot of people I don't like, and I can certainly control myself. But, you know, the problem is in our business that there's people that, you know, that like to piss down your back and tell you it's raining out. And, the last film that I was sort of working on, but I didn't get to it. I mean, every day was another lie. So, please, I've been doing this for, since I was 10 and I'm 107 now. So, give me the benefit of the doubt that I know that you're lying to me. And at least, it's the same thing with, in a relationship with a woman. You know, I'm a pushover boyfriend. I'm a pushover. I wasn't a pushover husband, but now I'm much more than half. I'm a pushover dad. And, my girls, they know that, I know they're manipulating me. So, hey, as long as the unspoken rule is you're manipulating me, I know you're manipulating, and you don't think you're trying to pull a fast one on me, we're okay.
You sound like my dad.
I don't mind that. You know, come on. Look, my three kids, I would do anything for. I would die for them. But that's the name of the game. But there's got to be, you got to respect the fact that I'm not a dumb motherfucker. I am, I'm a smart guy. And, I'm a manipulator myself. I expect, look, when I'm pulling shit, when I'm jumping over the line producer because she told me that I couldn't have the crane and I'm going to the executive producer, and the executive producer says, Kenny, okay, you can do it this time. I know that she's not going to like it, and I know that she knows, and I know that she's not going to like it. I don't care. My job, Sergio Leone said it great. I'm director, not accountant. That's what I think so too. As my job is to get the image that I want in collaboration with the director. I try to be budget conscious. God knows I've made a silk purse out of a thousand sow's ears. But, on the other hand, if I think that something, if I need something and I want it, and in my case, because of my own lights and stuff, I usually bought it if I used it two or three times. Cut me some slack here. I'll do anything for my aesthetic. I consider myself an artist. I like to think of myself as an artist. I like to think that I approach things that I've trained all my life. I've trained my eye either to capture life the way it is, and the other thing I've trained my eye to, not only see it and see people, but I've trained my eye, which is the art of cinematography, to light in a way that's reflective of the emotion of the script.
As an artist, what do you think is the most important film you've made?
Oh, that's a tough question to ask. But my most enjoyable film, as I said, was The Addiction. I think that Bad Lieutenant was a groundswell and opened up the door to, many, many thematically similar or at least parallel line stuff. I think the Funeral darkened cinematography. People realized that people's faces didn't have to look like they were being lit by, a 10K in the middle of a dark, dark scene. I think that Desert Flower which, you know, I love. It probably was the most important film I made because people saw it and it dealt with the 130 million women who are subjected to female genital mutilation. And, you know, if I could stop a bunch of, you know, there's 40,000 women that are circumcised in New York City alone on a yearly basis, mostly Somali immigrants. But, you know, you stop 100 of them, that's, you know, that's a pretty amazing thing. Maybe you just move somebody to, you know, look, would you have your daughter, would you actually take a steak knife and remove her clitoris, 10,000 nerve endings, and cut her labia off and then sew it shut so it's the size of a match head? That's what happens. The 40,000 guys do it, mostly fathers, do it to their daughters so that women, their daughters will be women that are cut and will marry other Somali guys. If you even suggested doing that to my daughters, I would cut your throat.
How did you get involved with Desert Flower?
I shot Sherry Horman's film here in New York, Goodbye America. And for some reason, you know, we considered her, even though she was in Germany, I was here, we had a sort of a correspondence. She's a very intelligent woman. She's married to Michael Ballhaus now. You know, she always, and her first husband, Jonathan Graff, who's a very big German director, is it Jonathan? I think so. Yes. He told me, that I was a great influence on him, all the films that I did in the '90s. He was a big fan and watched the stuff over and over again, when he was in Germany. So, she got the money to do it, and I was doing the Chelsea Hotel, and she flew with Peter Herman, the director, into New York. I met her we had dinner together, the three of us, and I talked to Peter Herman, and he offered me the job, and I was kind of stunned. I was living in Los Angeles at the time mostly, although I had my house here in Jersey. But so I flew back, and then I flew to Djibouti, and I started putting a list of lights together, which I never was going to get. And I had done part of Bye Bye America. We had shot in Germany, and the Harold, my gaffer then, was the head of Arri Lighting. So he helped me put together this list, and when I went to Djibouti, I realized we were never going to be able to carry that much stuff. So I mean, I did the whole exterior, night and day exterior with I had an 18K Arri Max, 2 6Ks, a couple 4Ks, and a few Kinoflows. That was our entire package. Because we had a ton of cable, no one had ever shot in Djibouti before, and that was amazing because I had little kids come up and try to, you know, get the white off my arm. They would try to rub it off because they had never seen a white person before, and you know, seminal. Really, for me, I would say a seminal experience going to Africa was really a mind-boggling affair. You know, I don't even want to cheapen that. It's sort of a cliche term, but it was. I'd never been any place like it before, and it's the hottest place in Africa. It was 120. Hadn't rained in 2 years, I had a very limited crew. Sherry was great as a director. Really great as a director, and. You know, I so want to go back there. Not necessarily Djibouti, but I'd love to go to other parts of Africa. Not shoot in Namibia or Kenya. You know, we went to Ethiopia, went to Kenya. It's lush, but I'd like to go to other parts because it is the continent of the birth of humanity, and you are stunned by the vastness of it, and you're stunned by you know, the overwhelming power of the continent. I mean, there are places where it's incredibly hard to eke out 24 hours. You know, the desert at 120 degrees where there's no water at all, where it's nothing but cracked, parched lands for acres and miles, kilometers, whatever. You have to, you know, I've been all over the world, and I've never even, I mean, there are parts of Death Valley that, you know, like Zabriskie Point, stuff like that, you'll see where it's similar. But on the scale, the overwhelming scale of, you know, horizon to horizon, you have to go there and you have to immerse yourself in it. And that's the amazing part of it.
Now, this isn't available in Region 1, it looks like, Desert Flower.
It is available. It is available in Region 1.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, so you can get it. You can actually rent it from this was a travesty. You know, first of all, this was the biggest disappointment of my career. I have this terrific film directed by a great woman who did a great job. Warris Dearie's story, Desert Flower, I mean, it's a true story. It's not really a biopic. It was a bestseller in Germany. So everyone in Europe knows about it. Over here, well, it's not a Marvel comic, so nobody knows about Warris Dearie. So in Germany, it's not registered. Gross isn't registered by dollars. It's registered by how many people go actually see it. So there was over 1 million viewership. Whoa. This is a film in English and Somali. Germany, they have that terrible, they dub everything. Oh, my God, it's the worst. There was 1 million viewers. It was nominated for the German Academy Award for Best Picture. They couldn't put me, I was ineligible to be nominated for Best Cinematography because I'm not German. And it did wonderful. Sherry and I were all over. We went to a lot of film festivals, Thessaloniki, blah, blah, blah. It was terrific. The people loved it. France, they loved it. Warris went on tour with it, et cetera, et cetera. So they decide to sell it to National Geo. National Geo is, well, we're going to get into the dramatic film business. So they hire a guy from the Weinstein Company, and he's going to be their guy. He hates the film. He hates the film. We're going to let this go on word of mouth. What kind of fucking bullshit is that, word of mouth? We don't have word of mouth. We have, it's called P&A. In Germany, they put posters on every, third telephone pole. Here, I go to the Angelica, there's like nothing. 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 I go to the Angelica, there's 100 people on opening night. I am so disgusted by this mess. I shot it. I bled for it. I spent 6 months of my life on this thing. I sweated blood for it. Sherry worked and worked and worked and worked. That's the normal deal. You do that, you don't expect anything. But you do expect if something has got the reviews it had, and the fact that it was up for a German Academy Award, lost to the White Ribbon, speaking of black and white Holocaust films. The fact that they wouldn't put any money in it just boggled my mind. And it was a poor choice. I mean, it was a poor choice whoever sold it to a National Geo who must have given him a song and dance. But, distribution is your nightmare. You can make the best film in the world. Somebody buys it at Sundance. You've now put every cent that you have, your mom has, your Uncle Charlie has, you sold your your high school football trophies, and somebody actually comes and they buy your film. And then it sits on a shelf for 3 years. Meanwhile, you made a few pennies off it, but what you want to do is you want to make the next movie. You got another script. And you want to move on, and that's the crime. That's the, that's that's the crime. But, you know, we're governed by people who want a sure thing. Oh, we're going to make Rambo 74. Well, why are we making Rambo 74? Well, because, you know, Rambo 73 brought in, you know, a quarter of the budget, the return of Rambo 3. You know, take a chance. Do something. I don't want to do the same shit over and over again. How many times people have come to me over, you know, 25 years and say, hey, I got something just like Bad Lieutenant. Well, hey, man, I already made Bad Lieutenant. And you're not going to do a better job of Bad Lieutenant than Harvey Keitel. It's impossible. You can't do it. I mean, look, they tried to do Bad Lieutenant 2. I couldn't watch it. It was so terrible. And made by Werner Herzog, the guy who made Fritz Giraldo.
Well, if it makes you feel any better, I just ordered the Blu-ray on Amazon.com.
Oh, you can multitask. Oh, man, great. Well, if you want, just go.
Frank probably has that one-click buying thing down.
Oh, man. Look, go to, you know, to YouTube. Look up Ken Kelch. There's a channel. It's got, you know, I cut like 5 minutes of 10 films. I put a little reel up where I did, what was it, a few minutes of Desert Flower, a few minutes of Welcome to New York, and a few minutes of 444. So it's there. You get to see it. You get to see 5 minutes of Bad Lieutenant, 5 minutes of 100 Feet, including me acting as the garbage man, the role that I was born to play. And
You just mentioned 100 Feet. We actually had a really fun – we had a fun podcast in the early stages of Podcasting Them Softly with Eric Red. What was it like working on 100 Feet?
Let's see. Well, all right. Let me approach this. Eric is a terrific writer. Big fan of Near Dark. I liked it a whole bunch. And The Hitcher. Oh man, The Hitcher. Terrific movie. And you know, it's funny speaking of sequels, they make The Hitcher with Sean Bean, same dialogue. And it just, like, sucks like a Hoover. So the whole idea of this amoral maniac in The Hitcher, terrific. So Eric and I get together. We talk. I'm living in L.A. I go visit Eric. And we did what I like to do, which is sit down and talk about what films we like. And Eric is an encyclopedia of film. So, you know, he gives me his 10 things and whatever, 10 DVDs. We watch them. I go to his apartment. We talk and whatever. So he's starting to cast. He's got the film, you know, I'm going to work on it. So we're going through female leads and, they settle on Famke Janssen. So, you know, I didn't really know her as an actress, except for the Bond girl thing. She's a model, and she was a guy who crushed to death her victims when she fucked them with her thighs.
Right.
You know, as far as, I mean, that sounds a great bona fide for a girlfriend. What a way to go. So, although I'm not sure why somebody would, you know, if I had that inkling, I would be carrying, you know, a stiletto in my pocket, and I would make sure I did my business first, but then she'd be dead. At any rate, so she comes on board. So I get a phone call from Eric and her people. They want to see my stuff. Wait a minute. Hey, man, you want to see my stuff? Now, I've been doing this for, at that, 25 years, whatever I was doing. You know, I just spent 2 years on Medium, you know, working with Patricia Arquette, you know, doing 10 pages a day, making her look, I think, pretty damn good. And, you know, hey, we'll take a look at that. Now, so they want me, I have to go on my own dime, you know, spend $100 on DVDs to try to send her people so that they can say, I'm okay. Because they said to Eric, we saw Bad Lieutenant and the Bad Lieutenant and the girl, the women didn't look so great. So what the fuck are you talking about? Number one. Number two, you know, look, my job on Bad Lieutenant was not the beauty light, you know, the incidental women and the Bad Lieutenant's basically horrible journey through drugs, gambling, and murder. So, whatever. So, finally, they say, well, he's okay. I get a phone call from the producer. Hey, Ken, we're going to Budapest. We'll pay your expenses if you come. I said, wait a minute. I got a contract with you guys. You guys owe me. You got to pay me for prep. Well, we're not going to pay you. This is pre-prep. I said, well, the funny thing is that my rate for pre-prep is the same as my rate for prep. So I didn't go. There's all kinds of that. That's sort of like, you know, set the monetary dealing with that. And, Fomka had got paid an escrow. She would scream at the producers and whatever, because she had her money in the bank. And, you know, I had to fight and struggle for my last paycheck. It was not a pleasant experience on the monetary scene. I finally got it. The union helped me out. But, you know, I gave up a lot. I went there. You know, Eric is, let's put it this way. Eric is a very determined guy. There's no real wiggle room. And, you know, as an operator, I don't usually react well to put the crosshairs on the actor with the 27, whatever. This is not my, strongest thing. I think that as an operator, as a DP, you know, you hire me to do this. Look, you tell me you want coverage, a close up and whatever. Let me find it. Don't tell me you want to get somebody that's going to, you know, blindly follow you, get some 30-year-old fucking kid out of AFI and that's it. I did what I was told. I didn't like it. And, you know, other than that, also there was other problems. Like I said, when we were building the set, which was a great set in Hungary, I said, okay, we're not the hallway, the staircase, it's not wide enough for a dolly. We'll never use a dolly. Everything's going to be a tableau. Of course, we use the dolly every second shot, and I was being smashed into the, you know, I mean, pulling along, and you could hear the dailies, ouch! Because I was smashed, my side would be smashed into a banister or something. So, whatever. All in all, I thought the film was really well done. I thought that there was mistakes made in distribution. You know, as soon as you sell it to TV in South Korea, it's going to be on the internet. I mean, this is this horrible day of torrent is whatever. So it got out. It was around. It got a bullshit release on a sci-fi channel. I thought it was going to be theatrical release. I like the film. I like Eric. I thought that that she did a fine job. She was very gutsy. I burnt the Panavision. That was interesting. I put a Panavision. Originally, they were going to put me in a bucket. I said no. So we put we had a crane, and the Hungarian special effects guys got a little bit overzealous with the diesel and the gasoline mixture, and they burnt the hell out of a Panavision Platinum. So they weren't too thrilled at the Panavision, but you know, had they got insurance, I'm sure that they dealt with it. I'm so glad that I wasn't in that Condor, or else I would have been fried. And that's not the way I want to go. I don't want to sacrifice my. Especially, I don't want to be emulated, you know, in a Condor getting a great shot. And I think the shot, by the way, is in the movie.
All right. Well, time permitting, I know we're I know we're kind of running out of time, but the moment Nick and I have been waiting for the most is asking you about Welcome to New York, because Nick and I both put it in our top 10 films of last year, and we just both loved it and have been championing the film hardcore.
And thank you for that, because I'm with you. I think it's the best thing Abel and I have done together since BLT.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, look, Depardieu, besides being a phenomenal guy, you know, he's done 200 films. He has, you want to talk about an aesthetic, he knows what he's doing, you know. The bravery of him taking his clothes off and
I know
being naked and the casting of those, you know, the two COs were, that was phenomenal. Come on, that was, that is like taking, you know, those guys, they are those guys. They didn't take any shit. They gave you shit. You're a scale, a mope, a dirtbag. That's the way they treat you. They don't give a flying fuck if you're the head of the World Bank or not. Get in there. Take your fucking clothes off. We're going to chain your, if you don't behave yourself, we're going to chain your fucking ankles to your wrists. And that's it. We had so many cops, and they were great. Every cop that came in there and played a cop was better than, you know, some sort of cheesy extra or some cheesy, you know, third-rate actor who was going to play, you know, Telly Savalas on you know, what's the name? On Kojak.
Kojak? Yeah.
You know, what Abel wanted is he wants stuff, which is our constant fight, that is natural. He seeks truth. So when I throw up a little Phil light, he thinks that that violates the truth of the moment, where it doesn't. You know, I have to explain to him that the art of cinematography, I'm not there to record an image. That's not my job. You know, if we are using the lighting of happenstance, well, why the fuck don't we just put a camera down on 42nd Street and 8th Avenue, and before it was stolen, we would just record 10 days of stuff, and we could carve out of that multiple stories. That's the same thing as asking me to just go and use the available light and capture the image in that. That's not my job. That's not what I do. Look, I'm a minimalist and a realist. The light comes in a window, as Sven Nykvist once said at a seminar I went to, the guy gets closer to the window, he gets brighter. He gets farther away, he gets darker. Oh, man! Hey, listen to that. Hey, all you 20-year-old DPs with your 5Ds and the Black Magics, take a listen to what I just said. Goes closer to the window, gets brighter. Walks away from the window, gets darker. It's not that hard. Oh, wait a minute. Light sourcing, you know, when he goes close to the table lamp, he doesn't get a shadow from the lamp. He actually gets brighter. He doesn't get darker. So, you know, this is what lighting is all about. But, you know, you have to have – not only do you have to direct – not only do you have to train your eye, but you have to – when you are interacting with the actor, if you're the – if say on this film – where there was so much natural light because, hey, I couldn't put lights. You know, that camera went on my shoulder. I followed him through, you know, prison. That's it. I mean, when he got dark, he got dark. That's the name of the game. That was found, caught light, and, you know, there was nothing I could do about it. I certainly didn't want to put a big battery-driven, you know, eye light on the lens of the camera. I let it go. But in that environment, you know, if I'm lighting a bathroom, like for example in The Addiction, that bathroom is going to, even if it's black and white, it's going to have the same sources that a bathroom should have. That'd be it. I'm not going to have, you know, an edgy backlit dark whatever, because if you went into a bathroom like that, you'd piss all over yourself. So you go in and that is aesthetic. The realistic way, the approach of it. Now, maybe Gerard Depardieu walks into the bathroom from hell. Okay, in that case, it's not brightly lit. In that case, there's flames coming out of the faucet, and he's being lit by that. That's a stylistic choice. That's something you can do about it. But my biggest problem was that, you know, Jacqueline Bisset, who was a trooper, man. I mean, this woman is great. And look, she was Steve McQueen's girlfriend in Bullet. She stole my heart. That you, in the Deep,
right.
Come on. I had the poster to the Deep in my room. Now I'm working with her, and she was very prepared and strong-willed and dealt with. You know, obviously, if you see the movie, you see the interplay. You know, for me also is my favorite scene is the Raquel and Natasha scene just prior to the rape of the maid, where, you know, I lit it so dark and, you know, they're on the bed, you know, fooling around with themselves, semi-naked, looking so – that's the sexiest moment in the film. And then when he's in the dark shadow, he gets in the bed with the both of them. That, to me, is – that's eroticism. That is bizarre. Now, not that I'm discounting the scene with the redheaded woman where he mauls her tits and just starts slapping them around – in this bizarre, fiendish, perverted sex act, where it's so far removed from the sex acts from any sort of sex acts, and it has that screaming, grunting, you know, feral pig like orgasm. And for some reason, I didn't know if that was going to work or not. But I've seen it with other people, and people are, you know, it's so abhorrent that it really works. You know, in Bad Lieutenant, it said, you know, kinky sex scene follows. And, you know, what happened. And, you know, the genius of a guy like Depardieu or Keitel is they can take sex, and it's not a fuck film. There's nothing erotic about it. It's just something that transcends, because it shows something about the character. And, you know, that to me, that's when you want to have sex that relates. It's not, you know, kissy face, blue Valentine. It's some sort of raw, unadulterated, kick me in the face sex.
You certainly achieved that many times in that film.
Terrific film. The film is all about attitude. The whole the scene with the student that I thought probably could have been done differently. People get confused about that. That it's a flash forward or flashback rather, and you know, this is a sex addict who just uses one woman after another. And, you know, without, when they cut the 20 minutes out, despicably cut the 20 minutes out of the film, you don't get that part. And you want, for me, and I think for Abel and the rest of the audience, you need to have that graphic portrayal of sex and then sex and then sex. And then, hey, you want some sex? Let's have some more sex. Because in true addict behavior, and I know a little bit about this, is that what we're addicted, what I find my addictions going to is not the substance, but the more. I can't be satiated. I need to go. I mean, it's not some bullshit film like Caligula where it's, you know, it's so theatrical and whatever. There's such a grit to Depardieu, and that's what he brings to the film. I'm 400 fucking pounds. I don't care. I'm dropping my clothes. I'm sticking my dick between his chick's tits, and you can either like it or not. I'm grunting and groaning. Well, you know what? This is my choice as an actor. I'm making it. It works, and it's staying in the film.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I mean, that film is as raw and rough and real as it gets. It's so good. The one burning question I have for you about the film is that final shot of the movie. I think, just completely knocked me on my fucking ass when I saw it.
You know, I couldn't end better.
No.
You know, and look, hey, man, the isolation of the addict, the loneliness, the not being able to live with something, someone, some substance, and not being able to live without it. I'm alone. You know, I'm naked and alone. You know, it just misses a fetal position and a thumb in your mouth.
Now, was that something that you guys knew all along you were going to do?
Yeah.
Okay. Because, you know, for me personally, I think 9.5 times out of 10, I can't stand it when a film breaks the fourth wall. I think it's just unappealing to me, and there's very few that I can think of off the top of my head that I think are perfect. But, I mean, for me, the be-all, end-all, you know, breaking of the fourth wall is in Welcome to New York. That final scene is just devastating, and then that happens, and it's just like, oh, my God.
Well, look, I think that, you know, do you want this guy to succeed? I don't think so, you know?
No.
There's no, in Bad Lieutenant, you know, there is a redemption.
Right.
It gives as Zabel keeps saying, we keep making the same film over and over again. And, you know, that's Nikki, too, you know. When you're asking about Nikki St. John, Nikki is all about redemption. You know, it's, I think that Abel is, I'm not sure where he is on his religious beliefs now, but always, you know, he'll never turn away completely from the Catholicism that he was drenched in his youth. Me either. You know, it's you know, the best thing about being Catholic is that you actually can have sex with the right person with guilt. I mean, Dominic's Devereaux. He is a person without redemption, and I don't know what else to say other than that loneliness Depardieu talks about the fact that he loved portraying a villain because he hates him. I think if I was an actor, despite my incredibly brilliant performance in, Does the Garbage Man 100 Feet, I would like to play the villain. I mean, that's what every actor will tell you. In Face Off, you get to do a lot. John Travolta, you know, gets to do so many more great things than Nicolas Cage does because he's got to be the good guy. You know, I want to be the guy. You know, I haven't been in a fair fight since I was 8. You know, That's what I'm bringing as a bad guy. I don't have a moral compass. I don't have any commandments. My commandments as a manipulative person is to feed my ego and feed myself and make sure that everything that I want is done. And I don't really care who I step on to get in the way. If you have to pay $1 million to bribe and get me out of jail, well, so be it. You know, that's just an unfortunate thing You made all your money from your father, who ripped off Jews that were going into the furnaces, and you stole their art collection. So that's my justification for my bad behavior.
I don't even know what to say to that. I mean, Jesus, I'm like speechless after that.
Yeah, but it's like, come on, that's the whole thing when he's sitting watching the movie. That's the point that he's making. That,
right.
You know. Who are you to scream at me? Because for you, it's an inconvenience to come up with $1 million. And besides, your father's money is blood money. It's tainted. It's that money is still have the souls of the people that that art was ripped from on it. Cheery, aren't we? Oh, man. Oh,
no, for sure, man. Jesus Christ.
Well, look.
What?
I you know, unfortunately, if, you know, I've done, you know, it's hard for, you know, it's hard for me to believe sometimes that I did, you know, stuff like It Had to Be You, and I was going through a horrible divorce at the same time. It's hard for me to, you know, Montana, a failed film with Tucci and Pierce Sedgwick. It was sort of, you know, pretty fun stuff. But, you know, hey, I'm interested. Obviously, Abel picked his dysfunctional brother, as I picked my dysfunctional brother to work for. Look, we share, you know, the same viewpoint. And although, you know, I'm a gun for hire, and I'm going to, you know, work with just about anybody who will, you know, give me enough money to do it. Although I turned down, in the 90s, I turned down so many films. In the 2000s, I turned down so many films. I got divorced. I started doing TV, which I would have never have done had I, you know, stayed married. But look, everything has shaped me the way I am. And, you know, I'm looking forward to the next project. I can't see me ever really retiring. So, you know, I always told my kids I was going to die next to the camera.
What projects do you have coming up, if you can talk about any?
I can't.
Okay.
After the last, you know, incredible disappointment where I had a contract and I was signed and, you know, and now I have a director who I was so looking forward to working with, walk and, you know, me go down with him. You know, rarely do I get excited as I did on the last script that I read. And, you know, there's a new one that came in today that's starting off really good. So I'm hoping that this will be my, you know, my next deal. And quite frankly, you know, I'm used to, you know, now that I'm back in my house that I've been living in for since I got divorced, and you know, I'm sort of isolated next to the state park. You know, I like the quiet life. And the thought of having to get up at 5:30 and shoot on five Fratterdays, you know, I have to be really excited to be able to do that. And I want to make a movie, but I don't know necessarily if I want to work 15-hour days, which I think really is inhuman.
Well, I mean, whatever you do next, you know, Nick and I are going to be chomping at the bit to see. So. That said, I did order Desert Flower, so I'm very excited to see that.
No,
fantastic.
You know, I want you to do me a favor. When you finish it, and you know, look, there's chick flick parts of it. You know,
it's cool.
The Sally Hawkins part. Sally's, you know, I love her, Tim Spall. Come on, the guy's just the greatest face in the universe. He was great, but you know, I fell in love with Sally, and she's just wonderful. And Leah Cabidi's model, who's, you know, gave up really a lot of money to go into Desert Flower, because if you pick up any Vogue you pick up, there's 10 pages of Leah. And she came to play. You know, it was a tough, and that's one thing I'll say about Fomka too. Fompa used to have bruises all over her body. She came to play. She was a tough chick. So for me, I admire that stuff. And, you know, for Leah to you know, to give up the comforts of her Fifth Avenue or Park Avenue house and go back to Africa. She's Ethiopian. And Djibouti's much hotter than Ethiopia. Is really, I think, brave. I want you to tell me the truth. Is it too much chick flick? We cut the circumcision, you know, not there's no pun intended there, But there's the circumcision of the little girl in there, which is really the hard. We had people quit over that. I mean, doesn't actually happen. And actually, we gave up. The crew took the money that they were going to get for wrap presents and donated to a special fund so that girl would not be circumcised and have a dowry. And she's 3 years old, but it looks so real. And and the woman who plays the woman who circumcises her, she has such a face, and she was the real deal. She did over 100 circumcisions, with a rusty razor blade, and she, God gave her the face that she deserves. So when you see the film, when you see her face, it's incredibly horrific.
Well, I will certainly be candid with you, as you have been candid with us on both volumes of our podcast. Once I see the film, I will let you know what I think of it.
Yeah, thank you for making a return trip. I believe you're the first return guest, so it's
yes, you are
definitely an honor.
We're gonna have a whole series, so you guys, whenever you get bored, you'll call me up on a computer, and I'll be more than happy to fill you in on the nuances of my life and how I was tortured by the last. Not the current one, but the last one for X amount of years, who, ripped my heart out through various orifices of my body. So there you go. And that's always good for a laugh or cry.
Ken, I'm certainly going to take you up on that. So you better believe it.
The thing is, nice to get somebody like Russo here. We should do one together. Russo and Kelch combined. Jimmy's in my graduate thesis film. And he's the best thing in it. I've known Russo for 40 years, and the stories that we have together, I'm surprised that no one just made like a 400-page book of that shit. So Jimmy is the actor version of me, I think. But there you go.
I'll tell you what, you get Russo on with you, Nick and I will write the book. Swear to God, man. A Kelch Russo podcast would probably break the internet.
I don't know if it's possible. I think that there would probably be a vortex of evil over the computers. In Ghostbusters, when the Pillsbury Doughman comes out, they would be popping out of the vortex. But, Jimmy is one of the most talented actors I've ever met in my life. And, he's as big a pain in his ass as I am. So there you go.
Yeah, Nick and I are huge fans of him. So.
Who couldn't be? Come on.
Right.
Yes. And believe me, his favorite subject is him, just like my favorite subject is me. So
that's awesome.
There you go. Guys, thank you for your time.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.